and the feeling reaction of yourself.
Because of the fact that in this, with the eyes closed, there's nothing to distort your, or to disturb our, your thinking process.
Yeah.
And so it turns inward, and you are aware of the inner goings on.
Good. Now, so we will try the same gesture now. And with the attitude I've just described, how you should put your mind in. Because I said religion is a do-it-yourself thing. So it's something you have to do to experience. I cannot take life's tragic acid and let you have the experience, you know. So I have to take it to experience. I got to meditate for the experience. You got to meditate for the experience. It's like eating bananas. I got to eat it to know what it tastes like. Right. So the same gesture that is common to all with a new attitude. Let's see if we cannot realize a little expansion of consciousness.
Well, let me tell you something else that I ran into this past week that I was just flabbergasted with, but even the scientists are finding it out, that when the eyes are turned at a 45-degree angle upward, even the mind clicks differently.
Because the encephalograph measurement is different.
Yeah.
You see, they are making measurements now on the various alpha rhythms of the brain in various physiological positions of the eye. There's a statement that once went, the eyes are the windows of the soul. But that's poetical poetry, description of truth. It is not that the eyes are not the windows of the soul. The eyes are the windows of the soul, if you understand it from the standpoint of truth, and be able to enter into that level of truth. Because these organs act like a lens. You see, it's only reacting as a lens all around, picking up light and leaving images in the retina, which is transferred by photosensitive chemicals in the brain, and in turn leave an image, which is a light image that the brain computes and keep and store it. Now, if you shut the eyes like that completely, the eyeball itself can only go in one of three positions. It could remain focused like that, or like this, or like that. Now, if I'm like this, there's a certain reaction in my brain going on right now. And automatically I can see three different levels of consciousness moving out. And if I keep it like this, there is light coming down. I can see light in various colors coming down. I can see the aura of them. If I look down, then I have a tendency to agitate old memories. Now, these measurements have been discovered to be so now in the human brain, and it's begin to be accepted by science. Now, Yogananda came 18 years ago and made this statement. But Yogananda didn't invent this statement, because his guru came 18 years before him and gave him that statement. And his guru came 18 years ago and gave him the statement. So the statement is a fundamental truth.
But it's only been stated as a scientific fact in the last
8 years. In other words, as a scientific fact, for the first time, religion, as a truth of the nature of ourselves, is being experienced. But now we have to update the language in religion. But that doesn't detract from the devotional attitude of religion.
No.
You see, one is say, this description of religion is so dry, so cold. But until you get the cold mush and heat it up and put the honey and the sugar, they can taste good. You see? So you got to heat up this action consciousness of yours from a cold state to make it feel good. So it is knowing cold facts about the reality of yourself that generates the true devotional attitude for self. Wouldn't be possible. You see, some people are born with tremendous devotion. They know that there is God. They have an inner feeling for God. That is the reality of themselves there, but they cannot explain it to themselves. And the only way they can continue in life is to feel a tremendous love for things, animate or inanimate. They cannot explain it to no one, because no one's going to listen to them, but this love seems to pour out of them. It seems to go out of them. Now, sooner or later, that very consciousness develops an understanding of the laws And it knows those laws, how it works. Now, someone comes along who has total desire to understand the laws first because he cannot accept this blind attitude of craving for God.
That's me.
He wants to know the laws, how they function. But after knowing the laws, how they function, and after being confronted with the evidence by a day-by-day analysis and positive facts of his existence, he realizes it's a waste of time to constantly pile up the brain with the information of facts only. It's about time I start to concentrate on devotion, experience. It's about time I experience the devotional nature. It's about time I really get some of these inner experiences that these people are talking about. You see?
And you can experience in that realm without having this
yes.
outpouring the sort of thing that goes on.
That's why we go into meditation. Now, let us have a little meditation right now. In other words, if I want to tell you about meditation, how this bliss is so beautiful and wonderful and simple, the best way is to taste it. I don't know nowhere else to get it, but we go inside.
Would you like to have your light out?
Well, you can subdue some light, you don't have to out all. You know, some people are scared of the dark. But why should you be scared of the dark? We're all ghosts in the first place before we became human beings. And we're going to go back and become ghosts and haunt some other poor human being. So there's nothing to be worried about. We're brothers of the dark, just as much as brothers of the light. So there is nothing to be afraid of or to any fear. There is no fear for God. God is the whole creative force. The idea is you're trying to realign your consciousness with this universal truth. Now, in meditation, normally you keep the spine straight, you see. And the spine is the actual altar of God, the eternal life principle, in the human body that is a temple. Now, every temple has got some little table which they call an altar, and they have a wafer and wine and candles that tell you that the Holy Spirit is present. Man is the only real temple in the universe. All the rest are imitations. And this spine is the only real altar. And the life principle is the only true God in all men. But man don't know that. Man has got to discover this for himself in order to be free. And meditation is his first attempt to discover the truth of himself. By keeping the spine straight, and not straining, and not desiring to see anything or not to see anything, just gently close the lids, but don't fall asleep. Keeping the mind focused at the point between the eyebrows. Now, since prayer has been accepted as a means of making communication with one's higher nature and other entities of higher qualities, it's only right that man can show some homage in making some mental or verbal statement to that effect. When the Master Yogananda was on the earth plane, he made a very simple prayer in which he included everything. O Spirit, Father, Mother, God, saints and sages of all religions, great Master Jesus, Master Swami Babaji, Lahiri Maharsha, Sri Yukteswar, our Guru Preceptors, we bow to thee all. Free our lives from all obstacles, that we may be able to realize the one reality within ourselves. Now, if the mind wanders, don't let that disturb you. This is a normal action. The mind can only wander in one of three directions. to some thought or idea concerning the past, and it will only generate some kind of an aggravation that you haven't accomplished it, or you did accomplish it. Or the mind can wander to something futuristic, and that too will generate some kind of anxiety. When will it come about? Or will it ever come about at all? But if the mind stays on the eternal consciousness of now, which is the present that you live in, and at the same time you are moving in space at tremendous speeds in relation to the galactic universe, at the same time you're an individualized creature on this one planet, the entire relationship of oneness now and the present now seems to reach out to infinity, that there is no end to now. And if all the stars are in motion, and all the planets are in motion, and we're on a planet moving through space and time with our fellow man, and every manifestation in the universe maintains its right orbit, then the universe is at rest. Not at rest by not by being inactive. The universe is at rest by being totally active. Active in harmony, active in mutual relationship to each other. This is the true rest. This is the divine peace that passes all understanding. Those who have gurus, teachers, or any patron saint, or have some ideal of a high nature, can center the mind on that. Because the mind loves to drift. Sooner or later, it will drift away from the present now. It will drift away from the one I am self. It will drift away from the one true knowledge of self, seeking either the past or the future. But if we apply devotion, that is an intense alertness to maintain that attitude of now, we can begin to experience oneness or divine unity with peace, the very source of bliss, the source where thought begins to flow. Beloved Masters, we thy disciples gathered in communion, we surrender all our ego desires. For the one true desire, God realization.
Heavenly Father, one universal life, thou have become us all. May we realize this truth, freeing ourselves from the delusion of separation, freeing ourselves from the delusion of being uninformed about ourselves. Having become us, we are now manifesting awareness and understanding at the various levels to which we aspired. Divine Mother, we who are seeking into ourselves may stumble upon many, many mistakes over and over again. But without these mistakes, we could never learn fortitude, endurance, understanding. Enthusiasm, courage, and dignity. Therefore, Divine Mother, the greater the challenge you present to us, the greater you supply us with understanding to meet the challenge. Let not this source of communication ever dry up or die out within us. Let us always be able to uncover the source of initiative, endurance, enthusiasm, creativity flowing from within ourselves. Let us always seek within the silent consciousness the intuitive nature that leads to the unerring decision. Beloved Master, we thank thee for thy presence. Bestow thy blessing upon this home in which this meeting is gathered. Meditation is the one source through which we can make contact. But greater than that, we should be able to meditate wherever we are, under any condition. In the busy activities of life, The bond of communion should never be broken between man and the Creator. For the Creator is in the man. May each one of us realize our higher selves as the true light of divinity. Now slowly open the eyes, but don't move. Try to hold on to the peaceful after effects. As you open the eyes, gradually squint them, not wide, gradually, adjusting the various levels of perception occurring right now within you. And at the same time, bringing back from outer space your association with life into the immediate relative realm of the room. Thank you.
Tell us again about the effect of looking upward in the eyes, or straight out, or down. Down has the tendency to help you remember.
When you look down, you automatically agitate the subconscious, you see. And those ideas that are residing in the subconscious or memory levels come up. So when you sleep, your eyeballs are actually turned down, you see. In sleep research, we have various measurements, and these, one of the things in sleep research, or what you call the rapid eye movement of that goes on, we dream, see. Now, dreaming is important to us. If we don't sleep and dream to a certain extent, something would happen to the brain. Now, it is not important at another level. I'll put it in a different way. Important things first. The more important things become important, the least important they are. Do you follow me so far?
Oh, you really got me mouthed up.
Important things are first, right? Everybody goes about shouting, this is important, he really does it first.
Yeah.
The more important these things become, the least important they are eventually, because there are other levels that you're going to go on. You cannot get stuck on that one thing, you see? So, dreaming is important to a certain level. But then dreaming is no longer important at another level. You see, you go past dreaming. Now, Master used to say that you dream by your own volition, through your own effort. And you dream because you have no volition. Now, you can create a dream yourself. You can close the eyes and dream. That is, you can begin to image where you want to be in the dream. But you have to take that flow or source from subconscious relationships. You cannot dream something that you, or generate something that you haven't been associated with on your own volition. Can you say, well, I want to dream, and stop right there? You didn't give no description of what you want to dream. And somebody says, what do you want to dream about? And then I said, well, Jesus, what is it I wanted to dream about? What is it? Is it, what symbol was it? What association was it? You see? Okay, I want to dream about a lamp. But a lamp is an association in a language relationship. You see? Now, I don't want to dream. And one of the funniest things can happen. You find yourself dreaming more. Because you automatically set off a condition in your consciousness that by not wanting to do something, the consciousness is pulling down from the subconscious. You've lived your life so long in subconscious associations and memory patterns, they gotta come up. So that's past. So the eyes go down and you're sound asleep. Now, if you hypnotize the person, the eyeballs don't go down. They always go up. You see? Now, when a person is dead, and you lift the lids up, you'll find the eyeballs are turned up. Now you notice, under hypnosis, and at death, the eyeballs are turned up. In meditation, the eyeballs are turned up. Now we got a 3-to-1 condition happening here. In sleep, the eyeballs go down. In dreaming, the eyeballs may also go down or go up, and it fluctuate, have an rapid eye movement.
Yeah, because I understand that's the way they can tell that you are dreaming, is the movement of the eye.
Right. Now, to stop dreaming and to fix the consciousness then is to put the eyeball up at a 45-degree angle. And this puts like a governor on the alpha rhythm of the brain. It stabilizes it. Now, in meditation, you are doing exactly the same thing. You are focusing it. Now, let's see if this coincide or validate religious thoughts. If thine eye be single, dash, the whole body is full of light. Now, where that dash, there's a word missing there. Because how can you make your eyes single? And how can the whole body be full of light? And this was a statement made by a great master. Now this is supposed to be a spiritual statement, a religious statement, yet it is a statement of fundamental truth involving God, creation involving yourself. So let's look at it objectively and see if all these things don't tie in to what we're talking about, shifting of the eyes. If thine eye... But it doesn't say if thine eye. It says if thine eyes, that means two. Be single. Be single what? You can't take the two eyes and pluck them out and put them into one. So it means you only use your eyes for one purpose, vision. So if thine eyes be single visioned, and that doesn't mean... It doesn't mean like some psychologists would want to say if your eyes are centrally motivated towards maintaining a straight and narrow path in your life. They don't mean that. That is a psychological illustration of that terminology. It has nothing to do with it. In fact, it's to share imagination to think of it that way. If thine eyes be single vision, that is if these two optical organs are focused in, like a telescopic lens, you would have what the Beatles will say, you have a kaleidoscope vision. Mm-hmm. Katie with the kaleidoscope eyes, the girl with the kaleidoscope eyes. But these are all facts of truth about ourselves. The light prism would work. It'll pull, these two nerves will pull in and focus and light will come out. The whole body will be full of light. You will see a light. A light is there when you close the eyes and look in. A light is there. It is always there. It has always been there.
And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. The uninformed is the darkness. You being uninformed, when you look inside, you see a little fleck of light. Oh, that's, I got bad eyes. I gotta go see an oculist. Four of, many of us have thrown away our, what you say, our heritage for pottage of, a bowl of pottage. That's exactly what we're doing. We're throwing away spirituality for something we don't know, you see. When thine eyes are single visioned or focused, the body is full of light. And this is the first tangible experiment or experience of a divine truth. That man goes back in here all the time to his God. God is eternal light. Now, but you don't close your eyes and look this way. Even if I pull the lids down, or I'm not looking that way. It's not possible. After a while, the ball has a tendency to rise to a 45-degree angle. Why it has a tendency to rise? Because nature has so constructed the nerves to feed into the pituitary gland that eventually the organ pulls itself up there. Now, once it's focused and it's fixed, and if you are fortunate to see that little light flickering like a firefly, it starts like a firefly and it swells and swells, and one day, as you constantly watch it or nurture it, or what you say, the Quakers say, sitting in vigil or trimming the lamp. These are only terms to say, do this thing, watch this particular inner light inside this brain of ours. It will explode like an atom. And this would be exactly what the Bhagavad Gita says, like 1,000 suns, and you would have an inner sight. Now, an inner sight don't mean you need this physical organ to see. It means that throughout this entire cellular mass, it has become an eye. Eye universal. Anyone who had these experiences know that this is happening to them all the time. Now, it is there, in that light that the masters see, which we call astral light now.
Is this the thing that Yogananda, at the time when Yogananda suddenly was aware that he saw forward, backwards,
kaleidoscope eye. What's the song the Beatles sing? Give me the kaleidoscope eyes. Or a clear vision. Clairvoyant. Clear. You see, it comes from the French word clairvoyant. Voyant means vision. Clear means to see through. Clearly, for the first time. To see through, clearly for the first time, through the organ, not with the organ. Most of us think we see with the organ, you know, but we are seeing through the organ. Therefore, we can transplant, do many things with it. This is for that reason, we understand what is happening in ourselves. We are seeing through, and therefore, Master said he was seeing through his head, front, back, and everything. Anyone who have had this particular experience know this is happening all the time now. Yet, this particular experience has certain physiological functions. These functions are there, it turns up and it's fixed. Now, after a while, you may be appear to the public to be squinting. Hence, we are all Orientals with squint eyes. We end up like that, you know. Now you can see why the genetic change of the Oriental from wrong eye to Dalman shape eye is too long squinting. Try to find the light, you know. Well, I'm just joking.
In the realm of stars, there's many suns or stars. The realm of stars, which you might find yourself into by allowing Master to turn your eyes inward rather than making any physical effort, would seem to me is only the beginning of the journey.
Oh, yes. I do not. Wait a minute. Don't mistake. I'm saying that this is the end, friend. No. We are discussing what has been slowly accepted and validated by science as a stepping stone. In fact, it's not a stepping stone. It's the mere fact that you learn to start the alphabet with letter A. You haven't gone through the alphabet yet, so A is the first one you write. A, this is only a relationship I'm using, or analogy, that the putting the eyes here and watching is the starting point of your journey. The longest journey begins with the first step, but where is the first step? You do not know how to look inside of yourself. So someone has to point out step one to the journey within. Now, this journey can begin under many conditions. Someone pointing it out to you, whereby you make a physical attempt to do it yourself, or you may be involved with an accident that you are forced into it. or someone can be ill. And in order to comfort that ill person, you may rock them to reverie or do something, and eventually find yourself going into that state. There are many ways that you end up, one way or the other, looking in yourself. In other words, this divine consciousness has so worked out the mechanics that sooner or later, one of the little traps or techniques that it devised, you're going to get hooked in it. To go back to letter A, to the starting point. You're going. In other words, the hound of heaven is chasing you to the gates of heaven, you know. In other words, this inner self is still pulling you back. These are all poetical description of what a thing is happening to us. Now, this realm in here is star-like. That's why they call it astral. It's like a star, there's no doubt about that. But why is it a star? That's the important thing. It's not because it's a star and we accept it as a star, or the star of Bethlehem. These are all information pertaining to this same thing. Why is it a star? And why is it a specific type of star? Anytime this light bursts open and slowly conditions itself, we will find it has five points, five distinct points. And these five distinct points represent the five basic principles of creation. Fire, earth, air, water, ether. And we are that. We are that in this human body. 16 chemical elements plus trace elements. Composition is matter of the human body. We got 19 more elements that composes the astral or electrical body. And the 19 plus 16 is 35. That is the 35 idea principles of creation. God, it's man. Long before man ever came along to realize himself, God already organized it and imprinted in an area we call the altar, the spine. Now, I don't say that the spine is unimportant or more important, or the areas of the spine are more important or least important. In the spine, there are levels. We have a lower level and a higher level. Now you have a positive and a negative. Now, below a certain portion of the spine is negative. Above a certain portion of the spine is positive. But therefore it resonates like a resonator. It has to resonate like a keyboard. Now, the masters don't tell you to start at the lower scale or the lower register of the spine to find God. They tell you to start at one of the higher registers to find God. So, it's not the Master Yogananda who said it. It was something that has been realized by all the masters of truth until it was put in a very simple way. For the first time, it was put, when thine eye be single, the whole body full of light. Or, none come unto the Father, cosmic light or truth, but by me, this inner light, this is this cosmic light. In other words, no man can have cosmic consciousness without acquiring intuitive conscious self-realization, which is Christ Self. Now, how are you going to acquire the Christ Self in yourself? Unless you go inside. And who do you see? A Christ-realized guru. He turns it on for you. That's what initiation is for. A guru only connects you up. The greatest relationship in the human body is the guru-disciple relationship. There is no other relationship, not even a mother-father relationship, can compare with the guru-disciple relationship. It is the only true relationship. Why? The guru is a manifestation of soul in active life. And the disciple is an individual who thinks he has a soul to discover that he's soul sometime when the guru extracts him from that uninformed condition. See, the disciple always thinks he has a soul. He doesn't know his soul. The guru knows his soul all the time, has always. The day the realization, the enlightenment has manifested itself in the guru is soul. The disciple is not enlightened. The disciple is not free. He's restricted by his habit patterns. He doesn't know. He is restricted by patterns of thinking, ideas that have come into his mind. So he thinks he has a soul. Now, the guru acts as a mirror to him and says, look at yourself, see yourself as soul, see what soul qualities are.
try to emit these things out of yourself. So if you have a problem, don't say, God, remove the problem. God, give me the strength to solve the, work the thing out. That's soul quality. Give me the soul awareness now to battle the thing. As the Yukteswar says, face the thing and the thing will cease to bother you. Well, run
face
from
the
face the problem and it will cease to bother you. Run from the problem, it will always follow you in some form or manner. You cannot run from truth, you see. You can only face truth. But the funny thing, when you face truth, all our pent-up imaginable fears soon find like a balloon full of holes. They don't really exist because you're uninformed at the time when you're confronted with the thing. The moment you become informed, you say, gee whiz, it's like a cinch, I can go through it. Being uninformed, then you have the fear, you have all the worries. It's like somebody wants to learn to drive. He doesn't know the rules, he's uninformed. And he fears. The moment he learns the rules and the information, he's informed in it, where's the fear? This is the truth about ourselves. This is the truth of soul. Once we are informed of the soul's qualities, there is no fear to this divine devotion. There is no fear for God in man. There is no fear to accept God in man.
Or to accept all experiences that come to you.
Yeah. You see, some Christians are get up and say, there is no other way to truth but by Jesus. They're not saying something wrong, yet by the way they say it to you, you will never accept it because they're not showing you the way to accept it correctly. Yet it is true that God is in man. But when you realize how God works in man, how he works in you, you'll be the first person to accept Jesus in his form. Much more profound a nature, much more an intimate relationship with Jesus in his true form than that man who'd be shouting all his life that Jesus is the only way to go to God. You may not ever have that inner experience that this is something happening. You see, there was a time, there was a man that lived in New York, a very advanced disciple, master. And he thought that he had achieved the awakening of the inner vision. You see? And he came to visit the master one day, they were at the restaurant in California. And he told the master, he says, I have astral experiences, I have this inner light opened up in me. I've been doing it for years, very successfully. So the master says, well, let's see, let's put it to a test. I see. So he says, well, I look down now, and they're upstairs, you know, in the Mount Washington. If anyone knows where Mount Washington is and where the restaurant is, it's quite a distance. They're upstairs, and he says, well, I look down in the restaurant, and I see there's a piano there. And the master says, don't you see two women, a table, and a chair? He says, oh, no, I don't see any of that. I only see a piano. Well, master said to him, well, then let's go down and check it out. And a psychic experience must be validated by reality. Otherwise, it's a bunch of imagination or suppositions. So, we want to know if technique and if a master's intercession are both valid. See, they have to be valid. A technique is that you are conscious of how to work it yourself. A master's intercession is that you may not have to know how it works, but it will work just the same. Now, both are important, and there's a reason for both being important. The student and the master went down, and when they got into the restaurant, all they found was two women sitting at a table with two chairs.
No piano?
No piano. And all these years, this man was fully evolved to the extent that he was very successful with his astral vision. And master looked at him and says, you know, you've been a victim of a highly developed imagination.
Well, was that all it was?
Yes.
Well, not only that, you'd have to admit that the astral planes are not anything other than kindergarten.
That we're not saying what is kindergarten or what is not. It is when you are confronted with a teacher or a master, he is out to make you realize the mistakes you're going to make. You see?
Now, I'm not saying that when you start to meditate, you're not going to see lights. You may see umpteen millions of them inside. It is the one light you're looking for, that one light that will open itself to you. And that's what Jesus and what all the great teachers are saying, that you cannot enter that inner awareness unless you pass through that one particular thing. Now, the masters have given three specific colors to this one light, and a specific shape to that light. And any time you encounter it, and if these three specific shapes are not there, or colors are not there, you're not going through it. It's then again the imagination that is at work. Now, there is an outer ring of that light that is gold, strictly gold. It's not a gold that you can even begin to imagine on this earth. I don't think you can begin to draw it or color it. It's not there. It's a gold that is so brilliant. But any time your eyes hit it or perceive it, you have a sense of divine vibration, love and peace right away. You feel it. It's there in the room. You can feel a tremendous electrical flow going on. You can open your eyes and still feel it's going on. You know it's there. And many people who have hit it will start speaking in tongues. They may even stretch out their hand and heal others, unknowingly. They'll fall back like that, excuse me, and the person next door can be instantly healed. And that's only the golden outer ring of that one light. They haven't even gone any further. Now, the next ring that the master is talking about, he says the color is blue, opal blue. And that is the Christ consciousness in man. Now, he did not say that was Jesus. And that is what Jesus was referring to when he said, "You see me, you see the Father." When you look inside and see this blue, brilliant light for the first time, you will see cosmic consciousness. You come close to experience cosmic consciousness. But you have to pass through that blue light into that white light to really say you have entered cosmic consciousness or illumination or achieved the degree of enlightenment. Now, this gold light has many wonderful experiences around it. This blue light is even, well, how can you describe it? The gifts of the spirit that comes with these awakening are obvious. No one can run from them. They're there. But how are we to realize it, and how are we to apply it in our daily behavior? This is the trick. This is the thing that is demanding of us. How to apply these divine gifts to our daily behavior without making it a three-ring circus. This is what we're wanting to do. If we're going to God and calling on God to awaken our consciousness, we want not to apply God's laws as a sort of a three-ring circus. We would like to know that we are attuned to the divine nature to work out our evolutionary life with an attitude of fortitude, understanding, courage, patience, and all the values and qualities that are truly of the spirit. In other words, the characteristics of the soul. That is what we want, because that's the thing that really works eventually. Now, when these characteristics are functioning in us, and that white light starts spreading, as a man thinketh in his heart, that is what he is. That from that day on, if you say something, it has to happen. As Yogananda once said to his sister, I am a man of truth. I've tried to speak the truth. That doesn't say what we call truth and what the master refers to truth is two different things, you know. Speaking of the truth, speaking of the reality, that is what he's talking of. And if I say to you, sister, you shall have your weight exactly as what you want, it'll happen within a certain time. And this has happened. And it happens in many, many cases, not only in yogic master's life. I don't like to bring myself into the picture, because then you think I'm boasting. But I'd say this. Once you know the laws of truth, how they function, you can say it
and it begins to materialize. Whatever you see will begin to materialize. And give you a little illustration. Jesus was preaching at one time. There was a Roman soldier who had a son that was dying. He rode all the way from his home to meet the Master Jesus, but he didn't know the Master Jesus. When he met the Master Jesus, he said to him, "If you but say the word, my son will live, or my son will be well." And the remark of that master to that Roman soldier was, "Never have I seen such faith in all of Israel. All the people who pretend to say they're seeking truth, never have he found one of them challenging or taking up the reality of truth and say, here is a realized man knowing what he's talking about. Say the word, do the thing." That, you see what I'm saying? Now, go. It's done. With the word alone said, in that concept, in that understanding of how this universal law is working, he didn't shout and say, "Dear God, please heal that such and such a person." Or he didn't get down his knees and pray. He said, "Go, it's done." Why is it done? It's because he recognizes how this man's consciousness was functioning. It's from the principle of authority, the principle of realization. In that centurion's life, he was a man of authority, having control over 100 men. And if he gave an order, it was, went down right down to the last man without question. Realizing this is how, on a physical plane, consciousness can work, he realized, without even questioning the saintliness of this realized master, of his ability to work the laws from the highest point to the lowest point, by the power of voice. He realized the same principle, so he asked. And the master just said the word, "Go, it's done." Now, we're seeing the same principle, that when this light, this white light opens up in us, at that time, we begin to realize, and we are illumined. We are illumined to the fact that what we say now can materialize. Now, if a man is in cosmic consciousness, the gift of the cosmic consciousness is not only the illumination to the reality of himself, but is to the realization that whatever he speaks or think can have a physical form from then on. Now, this may sound like a fairy tale, but it's not a fairy tale, it is a reality. And it happens to many of us, and we don't recognize it has happened to us. When it does happen to us, we're taken back the way it does happen. It doesn't seem that we have a control over it, because it seems too simple to happen that way. We don't see magical movement of it, you see. We can't accept it.
You don't see a lot of paraphernalia, right. A lot of equipment, a laboratory all set up.
Quite true. We don't see it, you
and
see.
And yet it actually goes ahead.
What you're saying, of course, is that the very process of incarnation is to be given exactly what it is that you wanted, what you desired to be incarnated. You came with everything that you needed.
All right. Let's go back to one fundamental truth.
But you still have to decide for the best.
All right, let's go back to the one fundamental truth. We are looking in. You see, you ask the question, and you turn your eyes down, you are subconscious. Now, if your eyes are straight ahead, you are conscious. Now, I can go into the consciousness another way. Where was I in the past few seconds? Now you realize what we're talking about. We're talking of various levels of awareness. Now I'm looking at you objectively, and all the outline, bone structure, and tissue is all bright in there. Now, I'm going to leave you and still look at you. Where did I go? Yet you felt something flow through the room.
Even if you disappear, you see.
Right? You felt something move right through the room. All right, so this is what we're talking about. We're talking of reality. You are all TV stations in a physical form, or radio stations in a physical form. Right now, I'm broadcasting, but I have no reaction on your body because I cannot link up to you. But the moment I link into you, that current has flowed right through the entire being. In other words, I link into the eternal life energy that is flowing through us. God is life, but he who must enter God through life. And you only felt it, you couldn't see it. You felt the flow, you felt an undercurrent, a strange undercurrent that is going on. And this is what the great sages are telling us. God is this undercurrent of life. He is there, a potential, a reservoir that we must learn to tap. And if we can tap it, we have many things to do with it. The creativity that alone we can apply, let alone regulate our behavior in our life. That doesn't say a man has to be a monk, you know, or to be a nun, or run away from the world. Far from it. In fact, the greater the obstacles a man would face in this material realm to maintain his family life makes him a greater saint. Why it makes him a greater saint? Because every instant he's challenged with the decision of to satisfy his ego or not to satisfy his ego. That doesn't say he doesn't provide for his family. That doesn't say he doesn't provide with dignity his own consciousness or his own well-being. He does, but at the same time he's not carried away to the extent that he becomes, on one extent, you say, ridiculously in consciousness or fanatical in consciousness. He doesn't run from anything. In other words, he faces life. Give an illustration. I think one illustration that I think few people are familiar in this room, and that is, if you might use it, is Mr. Johnson's son, Bob. When I met Bob, Bob had a problem of facing the draft, which is only normal in every American in this country as far as we go. I have another friend who was the same age like Bob, and he had the same problem. And this friend lived in California. But I met the other friend before I met Bob, and the same thing I'm going to tell this friend I told Bob. I told this friend, I can't stop the Vietnamese people from fighting. I can't stop Lyndon Johnson from sending people to fight. The army is a reality, it's there. You are a reality, you're here. Now let's see what divine consciousness can do to solve the problem. Now if you run away, that same problem will face you in some other form, and sometimes in a more tragic form. But if you go in and present yourself like a normal human being, I'm gonna place $1,000,000 to 1, Divine Mother will come up with something most fantastic. Well, for a while this boy didn't want to go. He and his brother had tug of wars, you know, like you're seeing the animals creeping out. Anyway, he went. On the way, that morning we were taking him to the induction center, we were driving and we were just about a corner away from the induction center, and he turned to his brother and says, Al, I don't want you to see me off. I want to walk in on my own. Stop the car at the corner. I want to go on my own. I'm going to take this Divine Mother's challenge. Well, we didn't reach the corner, and all of a sudden, whang! That was the entire noise it made. The car stopped dead. And he said to his brother, you just lost your water pump, it's broke. And this is a brand new car. We came out exactly at the corner away from the induction center. He says, bye-bye, Al, bye-bye, Adano. And he walked away with his little knapsack into the induction center, singing bluegrass.
Well, I look at his brother, and his brother looks at me and says, boy, I got a busted water pump here for sure. We got the car towed to the gas station. I says, don't worry, it's all divine water's plan anyhow. Found out that this water pump was wrung, like if a giant hand had taken it and wrung it out. The shaft itself was twisted around. It took a while to take it off. The man quoted a price for the water pump, and this price was on an exchange water pump of about $18, an exchange water pump for that model car. They phoned the guy and says, yes, we have an exchange, a rebuilt pump, and we'll send it to you. We waited, and the fellow came with the pump. When he took the pump out of the box, instead of being a rebuilt pump, it was a brand new pump, placed by mistake. But we'd already paid the $18, and he couldn't do nothing, he had to put it on. You see how, in one day, what has happened already? The boy has already gone in the army, and he's sent away for basic training, and he's about to be shipped out to Vietnam. So he's sent home for holidays to see his brother off before he leaves. He arrives home. One hour after he has arrived, he gets a phone call from his superior officer saying, instructions have just come through from above, transferring you to military police to be stationed in South Korea. And you have to come back for more training. So he looks at me and I look at his brother and says, well, you argue with Divine Mother, you did your duty, she got to do hers. So this is how it works. He went, performed his duty, as a military police, and he was shipped out to South Korea. And all the time that he was in South Korea, this is the funniest thing, he says, I'm not on the battlefront and I have nothing, I'm not wasting my time, I'm busy meditating all this free time. He says, if ever I got a chance to meditate, I'm taking it now on the government's expense. He says, this is my ashram. He says, this is my guru right now. He says, I've got it made. He says, 2 years sitting out here looking at some people trying to make them spiritual. He took advantage of it, and he not too long came back, and he was mustered out, and he's gone back and with his brother in Orlando. But Mr. Johnson's son was in a similar situation. That was a problem. And yet, when he went in, Divine Mother worked a particular way in which puts him in a position that he wanted to go to fight. He didn't want to refuse to fight, he wants to fight. He really wants to get in the action and pull that trigger. But everything he's got has kept him away from a gun. See, this is a peculiar part of divine law. As long you don't refuse to face it, the problem, the greater law comes to work. It doesn't come to work in a say, well, I, God, am going to change the law. It comes to work in subtle ways, because how is God working in subtle ways? He's working as the vital life force, the vital awareness of human beings for human beings. Therefore, God is in man already, but man cannot recognize it. He can only to build up enough momentum. But diving deep at intervals with tremendous intensity of awareness, this brings on much more. In other words, the more repetitions you make of diving into the consciousness in a shorter space of time, the greater the momentum will be than if you just make it a sort of a marathon action and forced and become frustrated. By going a little at a time, coming out, not open the eyes completely, half open it, and savor it, you know, it's like a good meal. Just drink a good champagne of spirit, and then you go back and take another mouthful and come back, and you keep dipping into it. Before you know it, you're getting further and further into the consciousness, wider and wider into the consciousness, and more illumined in the consciousness.
Tom, would you tell someone in the kitchen to start to meditate? so we don't have competition. Thank you.
Okay. Just keep the spine straight, but don't strain. And slightly close the lids and keep the mind at the point between the eyebrow, the reference point. And let the consciousness dwell in the right ear and try to listen to the audible life stream flowing through the body and around it. And don't be too concerned if the mind drifts around. This is natural. But what is most important about the drifting is the reference point. You don't want it to drift and latch on to an idea concerning the past or an idea concerning the future. You want to latch on to the present, what you're doing. In other words, as the man says, watch what you're doing. Watching, it's vigil. By internal watching and internal listening, the consciousness begins to rise into the pure consciousness. And the luminescence of the inner light begins to glow. And those who are listening sometimes you'll hear the celestial music coming from the audible life stream, the music of soul. Now gradually open the eyes, but not completely, in order to feel the presence of peace permeating you. Still being aware and alert. Now, dive back in again into the inner consciousness. Go as deep in and as far out and feel the eternal flow of life and joy permeating your being in the ocean of peace.
slowly open the eyes, but not completely. Maintaining the peace and the awareness. Now let us dive for the third time very deep into the ocean of peace. Heavenly Father, beloved Jesus, and the saints and sages of all religions, bless this meditation and grant us the protection to walk the path of the soul to its true nature and home within. Slowly open the eyes, but don't move. Gradually adjusting back to the environment and maintaining that peace from the inner reservoir of consciousness. Thank you. Cold. I'd like to meet all your folks before you leave. And frustration. Eventually he ended up in a temple thinking that's the best place, it's better than going to a psychiatrist because he can't afford it. So he prayed it would solve the problem.
Well, he was praying in front of the statue that he thought was ideal, and it was a statue of Shiva. But in front of Shiva's statue, there were a pile of books and logs and bags, all kind of books. Eventually, he was so exhausted in his prayer, he thought he heard the voice of Shiva talking to him. He says, "Oh God, at last you answer my prayer in this deep frustration. I know what you mean in the night of the soul that the saints talk about. I'm so glad that you can talk. But then, wait a minute, you're made of brass. You can't talk." So, but he's still hearing this voice coming through like a beautiful piece of music. So, the voice said, "Do you think what you have is any better than what you will get? You see all those bags and books in front of you there? They are the troubles of the world, of various people. If you can find one that is light enough to pick up, put in your back, you can have it. You'll be free from what you have." So, he felt each bag, each bundle. But none were light enough, not even the smallest one was light enough to lift up. They were too heavy. The only one that he could lift up was the one that he was carrying on his back. But just then a mouse passed in front of him. And the mouse was carrying twice his weight in the size of in a big piece of cheese. And he couldn't understand how that was possible. He couldn't even carry twice his weight, and he can't even carry smaller than his weight. And here is a mouse carrying twice his weight in the size of a cheese. So he asked the Lord Shiva, he said, "Lord Shiva, there must be some injustice. Why am I placed in such a position only to lift what I have brought? I can't even lift another man's, and here you ridicule me with a mouse carrying a piece of cheese twice its weight." And then he heard a voice coming back to him. He says, "Well, I told you, greater the man, greater the obstacle, and the mouse is greater than you. So that's why he's carrying part of your karma."
Oh, that was a good lesson, wasn't it?
Somebody is always carrying a part of our karma. In other words, something is being carried by or shared by others. Yeah. We don't carry all by ourselves.
Well, you might think you are once in a while. You feel like you are all the time. You feel like you're just as heavy as you can bear, plus that of a couple of other people.
Well, you see, an interesting thing about sharing or knowing that the load of one's emotional life can be shared or be carried by others mentally is a tremendous uplift. But that doesn't say you have to be negligent to the extent that you totally surrender and don't do anything. Then this is folly. This is an attempt to escape from yourself. See, most of us, because we are unable to carry our load, and then all of a sudden we're comforted with the idea that part of the load is being carried by others, we drop everything that we're carrying too, and want the other person to carry the other portion. But it's not true. We're sharing the load with each other. See, a master does not remove your karma from you, you know. He speeds it up to the extent that you're exposed to it faster, to the extent that you gain the enthusiasm and the courage and the will to be faithful to the truth, that you can overcome it quicker. So that makes you a better person. Now, if the master denies you karma and make you of what is called a life free from obstacles or conditions that interfere with a free flow, then the master is not true to you. That's the beautiful part of a guru-disciple relationship. By constantly pulling the rug out from under you occasionally, or challenge your wits, you know, making you more alert as to where the next test is coming. This kind of make you aware of yourself and the potentials that are in yourself, the godness in you. You're able to call upon it. we must realize that when we call on the godness in ourselves, there are many ways we call, you know. This is based on the way we are educated to call or ask, and what we want in certain frame of reference, like, "Dear God, I am very sick now. I need to be healed." One moment. "Dear God, I'm hungry. I need food. Dear God, I'm broke. I need money." All these things are essentially true, that we can pray like that and ask for it like that. That doesn't say it will not be fulfilled. But that is one level of calling on the divine supply. Now, there comes a time when that level works out. In other words, all the experiences involved in calling like that peters out. Then you up and get angry and say, "God won't answer your prayers." Like I met...
Isn't that in itself a test? I mean, you've had this opportunity all this time to call on this thing. Now it's about time for you to stand on your own feet.
All right. Well, this is good, because this is spiritual growth. This is spiritual maturity. This is the attitude of behavior, the right attitude. That is actually what your beatitude really involves, you see. Blessed are the meek, and or meekly wait, and murmur not. All these different statements are intended to focus upon this attitude, that you can and eventually feel that presence all the time. Now, the presence doesn't necessarily force to fulfill your wishes. It will fulfill what you need to be fulfilling at the moment it's being fulfilled. This is hard to understand, because this calls for surrender of consciousness. Now, it is hard to tell someone who's caught up in desire or caught up in...
What would you say, materiality, or...
No, you are living in a material world.
Yeah.
You're not living in the...
I suppose you're giving it first place instead of...
This is true at a certain level of your growth. You may say that I am giving this first place, but in reality, it is an essential part of your growth. Mm-hmm. It's like a kindergarten for your spiritual life. You have to give attention to certain physical things. But you may not give the true attention to things that are truly there, you see. There's a big difference. The true attention is not necessarily what the...
Detached attention.
Ah, right. You see, now detached don't say that you have a heart like stone, you know, you have no compassion for your fellow man. I don't mean that.
No.
It's to understand that there are times you should do absolutely nothing or anything to help someone, than to attempt to do something and not help them. This may appear to be very hard-hearted, but this is a fundamental truth of yourself.
Well, I'm lost now.
Now, in other words, your child is behaving naughty. You have a choice of doing two things: spanking the heck out of it, chewing it out with words, denying it its supper. One of those choices, put them all in one category of punishment. Then there's a next choice. You ignore him. You go about your work, and as if he never existed.
That'll hurt worse. Normally,
isn't that the same thing would happen if a guru suddenly came into the room, looked at all of us inside, and turned and walked out? Huh?
Yeah,
Instead of looking at each one and says, "Now you need 18 more prayers, you need so many more days in meditation, so many days in fasting, and so forth, and you need extra counseling," what would hurt all of us more?
To be ignored.
This is what they're trying to bring about, you see. Now, can I say he's hard-hearted? He is awakening a force in us, which we don't want awakened.
When you say we don't, are you thinking in terms of something that inwardly we feel we'd rather not have awakened because we know the consequences of it?
Yes.
Or because it means work for it?
Yes, it means a painful experience, something taken from the norm of your happy-go-lucky way of existence. In other words, as long as nobody don't aggravate you, you're happy. But it's been proven. The man who aggravates you to your best development is a man who really loves you. Then the man who fawns you and tells you you're doing good, he's not really helping you nowhere. You're still paralyzed with his happy comments. You see? This is somebody who probes you and tells you, come on, get off, and call you all kinds of names. Like in the army, you'll see that happens. There was a boy, you know, one time we gave him a we picked him up on the road, he was driving. So he says, you know, he's talking to us, he says, there are some fellas in the army I hate, I can kill them. And others, I just love them. So Sonny says to him, my friend Sonny says, what do you mean you hate the man? He said, one guy there, he's always picking on me. He's supposed to be my buddy. But he's always picking me, calling me all kinds of names and everything, and all the rest I can get along with. He's the only guy I can't get along. So Sonny says to him, he says, look, have you ever been in a close, tight squeeze in a military performance where you can count on the guy who was calling you all kind of names more than those that were calling you your best friend? He says, yeah, I think you're right. You know, that's one guy I trust my life with. And right there, he realized something, because he says, well, you see who really likes you? If you can have confidence in the man who picks upon you and have no confidence in those who will fondle you and tell you you're a good guy, why? What makes you decide inside that you can put your life in this man's decisions to, you know what I mean? The man who really is loving you and not fondling you is the man who is showing you your weaknesses in a certain way to make you stronger. And a master is doing exactly that. There are times he would not do a single thing. He wouldn't even say a word. He may just come in a room or come into your meditation and look at you and go out. And some of us, you know, say, gee whiz, I meditate.
It's kind of hard to see with you. You walk in and
But this is sometimes true, you see. That in this way of helping a person or a group is sometimes to let it ferment for a while. Let that consciousness ferment for a while before you actually do something. Now, the guru really does not do anything. If you really understand the guru is only a symbol of God in action all the time, and God is who is doing the real force. But God has become you too. But you are not recognizing it. So you're hanging on to the guru as some latch, you know. Well, here I go. At last I got my rabbit foot or my reins upon the horse, you can ride me into the gates of heaven. But you know, that was sometimes the horse stomp his feet as you go buckling, falling right over into the ditch. And he said, how come, guru, you let this happen to me? Well, here's an illustration. Our friend here, Pauline, was visiting with some people in California. There's a young girl who came all the way from Germany to be a disciple for Srila Prabhupada. Now, there's a beautiful young lady. Here she comes to work in America. She's coming all the way from a foreign country in high hopes. Goes to work in the restaurant of the organization and has a tragic accident, knocking a knife right into her eyes.
Oh, dear.
You can imagine the tragic emotional content with the mother, and they coming from, and they're the only two survivors of a family, what it is, and here she is coming all the way with high hopes that this is the place where you come to have spiritual life to have such an accident. You get a... Now, that is like being thrown off the horse. Now, but the horse, sometimes though it throws you off, may reach out and drag you out of the mire at the same time. Now that's what the guru is doing. The guru speeded up her karma. She was supposed by natural law of karma to have that injury. She must have done something to have that injury. Now, but how is the karma to be speeded up? How is it to be compensated? And how is it to be clarified or cleared out of consciousness? So she had to go through the physical pain and then to know that it's being healed. And it's all the same master consciousness doing the same thing. Now, this particular condition could have happened, let's say, in another 20 years from now, when its normal time was supposed to occur. And she may not have to be in the ashram of the master, and she might have been a married woman with 4 or 5 kids, and her husband might have passed on, and she's the sole support of the family.
And has
that. Now, at that time, she could have been anywhere in her 40s. Mm-hmm. Now, the reactions are different. Here, she's a young, beautiful girl, and it's happening this way. Now, right away, in the human mind, she's scarred for life. She's damaged. Her beauty and all, but she's giving her life up for an organization. You can see the whole
outward world.
Right. But then you have to see the underlying current, what a guru is doing. But it's not what the guru, the man, is doing. It's what God is doing through these forces. He's making you conscious of it. So carrying the load of others is a very important thing, because now how is the load carried in her case? The vibrations of those meditating in that ashram and the immense mutual love for each other going there. So that sometimes the love is not always pure, you know. Though we live in ashrams or around the feet of great saints, that doesn't say our love is so pure. It's full of cross currents, full of competitive reactions, you know. Who is more plucked out in petals in front of the guru, like a straight stalk? Who is more clear, you know, consciousness? All these things are flustering inside. But there is a common bond, a love for the guru consciousness, a common love that is there. That is carrying the load. Her feeling is that she is in the presence of others of like consciousness. She's in the presence of others who have the same motivation to realize themselves, no matter they have competitive attitudes. See? This is normal. If they don't have it, then we don't need to live in an ashram. An ashram is a hospital for sick souls. That's all it is. So don't look at it as something high on a pedestal. It's a place where the soul goes to be healed. But it's also the place where you're sharing the burden. And the burden is shared with you too. You're carrying somebody's load. If you remember one time I told you, in the Indian kivas, where they hold their ceremonies of healing, they do not pray for themselves. They pray for everyone in the room. Now, if each man pray for the other man in the room, and let's say there are 9 people in the room and you make the 10th person, how many times 9 people are praying for you?
I'd like to ask you something about that. Does everybody say, for instance, Myrtle, does everybody pray for Myrtle and then they go, everybody pray for another person and then everybody pray for another person? Or do you just pray at random? Does everybody just pray at random for somebody?
No. Let's say in the meeting it's like this. Let's say I've attended them, and this is how they do it.
Very interesting.
Let's say this tonight is a satsanga. It is a meeting in the kiva.
Yeah.
This meeting, it'll start like this. Friends, brothers and sisters, this meeting is being given by the Boris family. Now, they have a problem, or they have some condition that is involved. Now, let's say they have something they want solved in the meeting. It's a meeting for healing or something. Now, join me, brothers and sisters, with good thoughts that we solve these problems. Do not think of yourself. Now, they don't say nothing else past that point. And all through night, they may just sing and chant, and then they're going to turn around to someone and say, well, brother, you want to say some good word for the people? So in a case like one time, they pointed to me and says, well, we have a brother here who is a spiritual brother, and would you say a few words? So I prayed. But I didn't pray as if God help Mr. Boris or God help Mrs. Boris in their problem. I prayed that light will shine in the minds of all present, that this problem that is there would be carried out. In other words, it would be given a boost on its way out of consciousness. They are praying in their own language in a similar way. Now, it comes at a certain point in the meeting, a woman gets up and she's praying. She's asking for God in her consciousness for her sister, Mrs. Boris. They would call her Sister Joan or Sister Mary, whatever is her name, you know. They call him, or Brother Schmidt, or, you know, they call him by the first name. They're very formal people. And they're praying. They say, well, Sister Myrtle is in great need of help. We don't know what to do, but we are praying with good thoughts. So hold with me and join with me in this moment, in this dark moment. And this is happening at night. See, it happens at night, that they bring them out into light. And this thing goes on like that. Each one is saying something in that fashion. And it's keeping your consciousness always on the problem. Not the problem itself, what is the problem, but the source of this condition. Now, it comes just about dawn, when that light hits the dawn. That dawn comes, and the headman starts to pray now. His prayer is very simple, brief, specific, and it right there the miracle happens. He prays this way. He says, God and all the great holy ones that hold the universe up, and we are mere mortals. We are praying for our brother and our sister who has fallen from grace to have such a problem in their lives at this moment. But we only ask one thing, this morning, now, that they be relieved. You don't say, I'm asking you, Lord, heal the person. You don't ask you to want him tomorrow. You know, he said, this morning, now, I'm asking for them to be relieved. You didn't ask him to be cured. It was a big difference. You didn't tell him how to cure him, the person. And when you use that word, this morning, to be relieved, and you look over that sick person, you should see the turning of their body. And before you know it, I've seen people walk up. It's a simple metaphysics.
Is this carried on all night for the benefit of, say, one person, or do they take turns around?
It's the benefit for all. The concept is basically this. Problems live, germinate, multiply in the darkness of your consciousness. Therefore, it happens in the darkness of the night that you're praying. It's a very simple psychology, very potent too, if you can let the mind work for you. And at dawn, in the light, when man feels he's healthy, isn't that what you do in the morning? You wake up, you feel refreshed, relaxed, you want to vibrate yourself. So at dawn, they make a very important issue of it to say, now, at this moment, this day, be relieved, be lifted out from this darkness, see the light. All your religious teachings are saying, may I carry myself into the light. May I go out from the darkness into the light. May I drop my burdens from the darkness and start to live a new life in light. These are all the same patterns, you see. Now, they make a ceremony of this pattern system. And at that moment, when they make the final declaration, it is for everybody in the room. See? Sort of a crystallized thing. Now, he's finished praying. Then there's a second man who's going to pray. Now he prays in a different way. He's forgotten you. As the moment the head man prays at dawn concerning your problem, any person that prays, there are only two others that pray after. What they pray about has nothing to do with the problem, and never again you are mentioned in their prayer. Or anyone being asked for healing is not mentioned. Now, the prayer is entirely different. It's a prayer in which man and woman is recognizing an obligation to the universe. His love and his attitude towards the mineral kingdom. His love and his attitude to the vegetable kingdom. His love and the same attitude to the animal kingdom. And that same love and attitude should extend now to the human kingdom. And finally, in each one's own makeup, this love and attitude should extend into the spiritual kingdom. Now, they end their prayers off in that whole makeup. And you don't hear them mention that Brother Boris or Sister Boris needs more help. They've long... If you don't get a certain relief by the time they've asked for the relief, you better put on another meeting tomorrow night. See? That's now I have come to talk to these people, and they are relieved. Many of their problems are relieved, you see. Now, and it's been carried out. That's what they say, the karma is being carried out. The action. Don't think of karma as being something bad. The term doesn't imply bad nor good.
Well, because it is a law of action.
The action of lifting the consciousness from a one level of accepted patterns of thinking to another level of accepted patterns of thinking, whereby you are synchronized with life itself. And it's normal. This is the normal metaphysics of most of the what we call so-called primitive people. But it's a genuine metaphysics. It's a genuine religion. That, in fact, this is the true Christianity.
What is the name of that religion?
Christianity.
Just Christianity?
Yeah. What is Christianity?
That sounds like
No, this is just, I'm not trying to make things sound facetious or anything, but we use the word religion, and we really don't know what we are saying until we investigate into it. Then we will find that this word breaks up into three categories. One, it breaks up into churchianity, or doctrines, certain prescribed creeds, do's and don'ts of existence, which eventually become legislation, politics. Then you go into another category of this word religion, it runs into organization, and the kids call it the establishment. They're right, because you can't fight the establishment, it's because it's already preset for man to exist in a certain organized form of existence. He's a cultural creature. Now, when you look at the last aspect of religion, and you see now an intelligent search into the reality of yourself. Now, this is the last part no one wants to know about, because this is the part that is ego-shattering. To know that you are an organism that must work out certain modes of behavior and gesture in order to realize the trueness of your nature, this calls for work. You see?
And it isn't always pleasant.
No, it's not pleasant work. And sometimes it's very, very abrasive, you know. It rubs too hard on the ego. And sometimes it leaves little scars there, you know. But this is the third part of religion. Now, it is this part that man really should be interested in. It makes for the foundation for the other two parts. The other two parts have a legitimate reason to exist. That is the establishment, the organization, and the doctrines that lead to legislation and behavior in the moral society. But they have no basis in a genuine way without the third part, the reality of man himself, what he is. Until you know what you are, these two have no value. They fluctuate, and therefore we are hypocrites to ourselves. That's why if the kids say you're a hypocrite, he may call himself a hippie. But it has no degradation or anything. It's a fact that one is seeing the falsity in certain things that he doesn't want to associate with. In other words, we are trying to find a vantage point that corresponds to the laws of nature in order to live our lives. And the third part is where we begin. Now, the third part is pure science. When I use the word science, don't think in terms of some test tube or some file of mathematical conditions. It's a science, and at the same time, it's an art. First, it must correspond in action to all that the laws of creation are involved with. And this is truth itself. The scientist is aggravated when you talk to him about religion, because he is caught up in the first two categories, the doctrinal part and the organizational part. But he would be willing to listen to the third part, the scientific nature of it, where it fits, because he will begin to see a relationship. You will see the identical thing that he's searching for. Now, it is this part that certain primitive tribes have learned to ingrain in their consciousness unused. They have sifted out certain conditions that they've observed over the years and apply them, this certain simple rules of the third part that they've learned to use, and they found it very, very effective. Now, the third part involves of an attitude or a gesture which you call prayer. You see? Now, don't look, I'm not using the word in any degrading sense. I'm trying to show you a point in which this one peculiar gesture or behavior remains in every so-called religious group. There is a tendency for men to get into a mood or a gesture or an attitude of supplicating an unknown force to solve an immediate problem. And by talking it out with this unknown force in his own little way, he's hoping that this unknown force is going to solve the problem. This is the mechanics of what is occurring in prayer. Now, but this prayer mechanics is, can be divided into three levels. It can be a rabbit foot level, where you rub it like a rabbit foot and ask for something, or a genie in a lamp, you know, big boons or whatever. Or it can be a facing up of yourself in relation to how you live your life. This condition brings release. This condition brings you to the source of what you're really searching for. It brings you that calmness. It brings you the inner peace that you're looking for, the inner joy, the inner wonderment of being alive. And at the same time, it brings you the inner satisfaction that something is working through you and allowing you to experience those values that are not normally acceptable in the convention we live in. See, certain values that convention accept become very pat and don't right. Now, if you have this a sudden opening up of consciousness, you start to see there are greater values beyond that. And for the first time, you start to have an extension of awareness as to what a real value of a thing is.
I'm wondering, when that extension, you're speaking about extension of awareness there, Gladys and I both have been taking this course, and this is a scientific approach to the same thing. And when you say awareness, I think this is what this man is trying, Mr. Silva is trying to tell us, is going down into this realm of the inner consciousness, really. The sudden awareness is a thing that will take you to that area that produces a result. Only when you reach that you've got a result.
All right. If you backtrack a few, you'll find out there are a few words you've used that give you the clue to the manipulation of the thing.
Right.
The going down, keep that statement in mind. The sudden These two statements are the master keys of triggering consciousness all the time.
Sudden going down.
Tonight was a sudden, unexpected, and yet expected manifestation of my presence here, right? And look, the reaction, what occurred, it broke all tension and allowed bliss to flow. If you can understand this peculiar mechanics, this is how consciousness really works. This is how superconsciousness is possible for us. When the restrictions are pulled apart, it is like you sucked in, you see? It is a sudden pull out. It takes you unaware. And because it takes you unaware, there's a certain amount of fear in all of us. The fear of the unknown, what would happen, what to expect. It doesn't conform to the information written in a book. In other words, life don't flow through a mother and her baby the way it is written in a doctor's manual. The child is being carried into through labor and into the operating field, you know. It's the same thing. You can read of this thing in a manual, but it doesn't function like that inside the person. You can read or hear of the awakening, but the sudden shock of the awakening from one level of awareness to another level is something else. You're not ready. It'll pull the whole roof apart. But if you can recognize that something is happening inside of you, and if you don't fight it, you see, this is where love and pain are two qualities or two conditions that come in to make this awareness of yourself sharper. Pain comes and you're forced to excuse yourself. I'm gonna fight this pain. And then I'm going to call on this God to help me. And brother, if he don't help me, I'm going to curse the hell out of him. Then love comes along. What for? Guilty complex. Guilt complex. How can God not help you? He made you. And you start talking all over to yourself in circles. And before you know, you're relaxing. You stop tensing up. And then in relaxing, all of a sudden, you get so goddamn tired. You fall asleep. But when you open your eyes, you feel refreshed. Thank God, we start all over again. These are various things we happen to most of us at times. We go through a series of arguments for or against in pain and suffering. Come out. Masters are only saying to us that we must learn the science of this consciousness or religion in order to manipulate it. Now, when I use the word manipulate, I don't mean you're going to use it to go around performing like a circus, you know. This is not what this was intended for. Religion is intended primarily to reunite soul with God. Your consciousness with this inner consciousness. It's a reunification. It's a refamiliarizing yourself with something that you were once familiar with. In other words, there was no time that you were never familiar with God and knew His presence. And every time you become re-exposed to it, it was also familiar to you. It's never new. But the familiarity of it and the re-exposure to it is new because it's happening in a new body, which you think is a new body for you.
And your other consciousness of it has blanked out.
Right.
And
thank God for inventing forgetfulness. If you don't thank him for inventing that, how would you get the beautiful experience of a new condition?
Is there enough of it that remains that when it does happen, it sort of begins to bring back an awareness of it, increases its the joy of the thing, so
yes.
that there's an instinctive want for more of it.
Right. This is true. This is happening to us. It's an amazing thing what happens to us when we realize it. Now, the thing is that the masters want us to explore our real nature. This is something that we don't seem to want. We would rather not explore our inner nature to know who we are, in case we don't want to accept what we are. Now, the second reason why we don't want to explore our inner nature is that we may not have any control, because we are still limited creatures in a certain sense. Now, another reason why we don't want to explore is that you don't know what to expect. Now, your greatest enemy in this universe is not the devil. The greatest enemy in this world is being uninformed. Because once you're informed, you have no fear no more.
You know about, you don't fear.
So the devil, what is he? If you are informed on him, what fear have you got for him?
All right.
But you're uninformed with God. This is the peculiarity.
Yeah.
Just as much you're uninformed as to what this so-called devil is, if it does exist, you see. Being uninformed is the real problem in the human consciousness all the time.
And that isn't going to arise too much out of book learning, so much.
It does not come from books. If it could come from books, then you take all the library, sit down and read it. So the sages then had to come up with a way to get back into man. And they tried prayer as a stepping stone. Not that prayer was the ultimate process. It was a stepping stone. Then they found that was not enough, because sooner or later man got so involved with, he made long rotary prayers, you know, and even went to the extent he made sticks and all kind of banners to make his prayer mechanical. So he lost the concept. Then they found that evolution of consciousness must come on. The next step went to analysis and reason. Why do I have to pray? In other words, I'm getting a little smarter now than my fellow men. So that is the next level. We start analyzing. And we analyze till we reach a point that there is no more analysis. Because it seems like we're going like a dog chasing its tail with the analysis. We're never getting anywhere. Then comes along someone who says we should try meditation. Now, why we should try meditation? Only because he seemed to solve some of the problems that most people have with the least amount of effort on his part. Now, some people look at those individuals and say, gee, he's got the luck of the Irish. Or he's wearing some four-leaf clover or something. He's always lucky. He's never in a scrape. He's always seemed to, he can, backing up to the wall, he seemed to get out. It is not that he has luck or anything. He has discovered, by stop analyzing and slowly quieting his consciousness for a brief moment, he can think more objectively. He can think constructively for the first time. In other words, he can channel his thoughts for the first time. Therefore, he is seeking a median, a measurement, to be one with truth for the first time. Now, he starts to meditate. And he discovers by that attitude certain things that have been there all the time, from childhood up to that moment, but he never realized they were there. One, he discovers that he's calm. He's more collective. Two, he discovers that there is an inner light that flows within his brain. Three, he discovers there is music in the atmosphere that he normally does not recognize was there. Now, four, he discovers an extended awareness of things around him that he did not normally recognize were there. In other words, he seemed to step into time a split second ahead of his fellow men in awareness. This makes him conscious now that there must be something to meditation. Then he's caught up in is it good or bad? Is what I'm doing evil or is it, he's got that guilt complex coming right now. So he starts looking for friends to talk to. But there aren't too many friends that he can tell this experience to because they themselves never had it. Now those that he would meet who would talk about it don't want to talk about it because they would think they're all nuts. So spiritual people have very few friends. But religious people have lots of friends because they can take the Bible and dissect it from cover to cover and debate in rhetoric all over the whole thing and have friends. But a spiritual person can have because can he walk over and say, last night when you sat down to meditate, Myrtle, did you see the blue light? Did you see the red light? Did you see? You said, I didn't get any, Sister Jill or Brother Smith. I didn't get any. Well, you see?
Are you sure we shouldn't call him the little man?
Right. It's very hard to communicate something that's happening inside of you because it's too individualistic, too personal. Yet there is a common link. We must see if the common link exists for us. And there is the common link. The common link, at every time you attempt to meditate, you feel a sense of peace, joy, and a widening awareness of yourself. When I use the word a widening awareness of yourself, I am saying that there's a tremendous intensity vibrating out of your being to think, to understand, to feel and react. And that this is infinitely flowing stronger, pulsating more and more with greater momentum every second that you widen this awareness. This is a big difference because you're starting to see the infinite, unlimited source of your consciousness that is there all the time pulsating. Then you can go in and merge with it. Now, so someone will say to you, all right, meditation is good. Could you illustrate it to us? Well, to illustrate meditation to someone, you're stuck.
Yeah, because this is something different.
Right. But you've got a way to give some external action, and that is gesture. By gesture, you can communicate your consciousness or the mood of your consciousness that you're in. And it's true that we can have some common bond. Now, those who have seen this gesture, the placing of two palms together, thumb and the four fingers together like that, and place it right over the heart, and slightly closing the eyes, what would that communicate to us in this room?
Penitent soul.
You give it a little of simple mechanical action, and I, in my mind, may call you all sorts of names. Do you see? You don't really say that my gesture tells you what my consciousness is all the time. So when you say somebody is now meditating, doesn't say really meditating.
Yeah.
This is what you got to realize.
Somebody can come in like this and have evil in their heart.
All right. But we will do something else now. If we close our eyes for a brief moment, but do not fall asleep, because closing the eyes does have a tendency to make you sleepy or drowsy. For a brief moment, but do not fall asleep, because closing the eyes does have a tendency to make you sleepy or drowsy. And you don't want to fall asleep, you want to be aware. That means you want to be awake, but at the same time you want to experience this condition of having closed eyes and not falling asleep. Now, to experience something in that gesture is an expansion of awareness. It's an expansion of something that you never experienced before. It's an experience that is new and is going to have certain rewards. That is, it is going to widen your understanding of yourself and the feeling reaction of yourself.
Because of the fact that in this, with the eyes closed, there's nothing to distort your, or to disturb our, your thinking process.
Yeah.
And so it turns inward, and you are aware of the inner goings on.
Good. Now, so we will try the same gesture now.